And our special guest, Robert Zimmerman, this hour. We're going to take your phone calls with Robert, so get ready to make the call. We'll be back with him and more on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back with space historian Robert Zimmerman. George Norrie back with you. We'll get your calls this hour as well. Robert, what's going on the planet Venus? Anything exciting there?
Well, there was a lot of fake excitement about a few months ago. Scientists thought they found evidence of a very, very, very tiny amount of the chemical molecule phosphine in the atmosphere. Phosphine on Earth is only found in connection with life processes on Earth. And so, and the scientists pointed that out in their paper, but they immediately said, you know, this is really not likely a connection with life. They tried to immediately de-emphasize that. But the press went absolutely nuts. Life on Venus. Oh, my gosh, there's life on the
atmosphere. It's too hot there. It's too
around.
Hot.
We got to send millions of missions down. A lot of scientists, by the way, in their effort to gin up money for missions. I'm not against the missions, but this was an effort to lobby money. Piled on to that frenzy and said, yeah, we got to find life. Since that time, there have been a number of good scientific papers that have pointed out, one, no, there's no life there. Two, the result itself is extremely tentative. There might not have been any phosphine in the atmosphere. It might have been a misreading of the data. And third, it doesn't mean there's life. It means they have found a very strange a presence of an unexpected chemical in this extremely alien atmosphere.
What's the temperature out there?
Oh, it's about 900 degrees. You're talking about a very hellish place that's completely alien to anything we know, completely alien. It's not only is it 900 degrees, the atmosphere is very, very dense. It's mostly carbon dioxide, but it also has sulfuric acid in the atmosphere, clouds of sulfuric acid. It's like hell. Plus, it has many chemicals in the atmosphere that we have detected spectroscopically that we do not know what they are. We see them. We see the different brightnesses in different wavelengths, but we cannot yet, and this is going back 50 years of observations since the first planetary missions flew past Venus or have orbited it, but we do not yet know what those spectral signals mean. There's lots of unknowns here. This is a really alien planet. Now, outside of that that false frenzy from a few months back, there have been an increasing resurgence of interest in sending missions to Venus. There have been a few missions. The United States has not had a mission in 30 years since the Magellan Orbiter. And now it's beginning to money is now being spent to develop two different missions, orbiting missions, one of which will send a sphere into the atmosphere to check the atmosphere out and take pictures of the surface. But Europe is sending a mission. India is developing a mission right now. And so there are there is an orbiter around Venus.
How about Russia? Are they doing anything other than renting their spaceships to us?
They don't have the money to build anything. They're trying, but they haven't had a successful planetary mission of their own in half 40 years. They have a mission they're going to try to launch no later than next year. To the moon, a lander on the moon, and it'll be their first lander to the moon since the 70s. But they have not had a successful mission to planetary mission in more years than I can count. And they've tried a few times in the last 30 years, and every single one of them has failed. The Russian program has got lots of problems. They're trying to come back to life, but they have many, many problems. So anyway, Venus, lots of going on. That's beginning to pick up pace at Venus, but we got to remember how alien that planet is. And it just underlines a fact that anyone who wants to know about planetary research should be aware of, that every single object we've taken a close look at, planets, moons, asteroids, comets, every single object we've looked at in the whole solar system has been entirely unique and not like any other object we've looked at. And a great example of that is Pluto and its moon Charon. They orbit each other. They're out in the farthest reaches of the solar system. You'd think they would be similar to each other. They're right next to each other. They orbit each other. They're not. That was one of the big surprises when New Horizons flew past. They are completely different. And their geology, their chemistry, it's it's like they formed completely separate from each other and then decided to shake hands and form an orbiting partner, get married. But they're different. And that applies to every object in the solar system, and Venus is another example. It might be about the same size as Earth, but in every other way, it is different. And that applies to Mars, to the Moon, to Ganymede, orbiting...
How about Saturn, Jupiter? What are we doing there?
Well, we've got an orbiter around Jupiter called Juno, and it's been taking lots of pictures, but it's mainly designed to study the atmosphere, the magnetic field, and the interior of Jupiter. So pictures are not its main issue. And so it's been studying, it's been able to detect some information about the interior of the planet. The atmosphere is much deeper than they thought. They also recently did a flyby of the moon Ganymede. Ganymede is the largest moon in the solar system. It's bigger than Mercury, so though it's a moon, it's a planet. And they did the first close flyby of that moon planet since the 90s, and were able to get closer pictures. I posted them on Behind the Black because they're kind of cool, and it gives an opportunity to get an eye, you know, more. The geology there is also totally unique and different than anything they've seen, and completely baffling. They don't really understand what they're looking at, and they didn't understand the 90s, and these pictures really won't help them understand it anymore, but it gives us a little more data point in trying to figure it out.
Let's go to the phones. Let's start by going to Bill in Los Angeles. Welcome to the program. Hey, Bill.
Hi, George. Yeah, I remember that Sunday in 1969, that moon landing, just like it was yesterday.
Yep, so me too.
Really,
yeah.
Glad you mentioned that. Bob, you're the man. As a no-nonsense rocket aviation expert, who do you think built that fleet of supersonic aircraft photographed over D.C. in 1952 that outran our F-86 Sabre jets and the ones caught on Navy FLIR videos?
Ah, I love
it. 10,000 miles an hour.
I have no idea. I can't answer the question. I'm not going to speculate. As you say, I'm no nonsense. I like to know some facts. I will say that that a lot of the more recent revelations about
you've got to be intrigued with
UFOs
Robert.
By the military. What people have to recognize is that the drone technology that has been being developed by militaries worldwide right now is becoming incredibly sophisticated. And in truth, many of the drones that have been built can make the kind of maneuvers we've seen. And when you put in conjunction with the distortion of the moving plane and the atmosphere and perspective that can distort what you think you see, drones can very much do this kind of stuff. And so we should be aware of that. We should be aware, too, that the military, if it's developing such things, it has motives to spread disinformation. And the kind of disinformation it might spread is to get people thinking, oh, it's UFOs, aliens, to keep people from thinking, oh, it might be military operations. So I have no idea about 1952. I can't speak to that. But I can talk about at least the UFOs that have been so-called claimed by the Navy. Nothing I have seen convinces me this is aliens in space, and I think about modern drones and a lot of the research that I've been studying about what they can do, and it immediately comes to mind that's what we're looking at.
That's what you think it is. Do you think it's Chinese? Russian?
I can't answer that question. Yeah, maybe. Who knows? I would say that Russian, less so, because the Russians, once again, have many financial problems and corruption in their
right.
society that makes it hard for them to achieve almost anything these days.
At what point do we stop renting their rockets?
We have stopped renting
to get up to the ISS.
It's one of the reasons they're flying two tourist flights this fall. They're one of the ones flying tourist flights. And it's one of the reasons they're shifting their crew to year-long missions on ISS. They want to open up seats to sell tourist flights because they're not getting cash from our government anymore. And so because we've got our own Dragon capsule and Starliner is just about to turn the corner, and so they don't get our money anymore, so that they're flying tourist flights instead. China is the one that I would be concerned about in terms of the technology. They are very, very good right now.
They're coming on like crazy.
They are a threat. There's no doubt about it.
Next up, let's go to Jesus in Guatney, California. Jesus, thanks for calling.
Hello. Hi, guys. Hi. I just had a question for the guest. What do you think about meteors, hitting the Earth?
It's a threat. Is it a threat that we should be
and asteroids.
Fighting our nails over? No. Right now, NASA And astronomers, not just NASA, have been doing extensive surveys of the solar system and have got, I would say, a good census of most of the largest objects that conceivably could threaten us. And they pretty much know, I would say, a large percentage. There are objects that travel in orbits that are difficult to observe, and that's where the unknowns are. The odds of a big object hitting the Earth and doing significant damage is not high. But it exists, and there's no doubt that for our own future, we should be. This is another reason to become a spacefaring society, because once you've got a very robust in space economy and civilization, they're going to have in space the technology and the skills to very quickly deal with these problems, as well as do the kind of observations of those difficult to observe orbits that we can't do on Earth. For example, objects that orbit the sun closer to the sun are very difficult to spot. If they have an eccentric orbit, a slow eccentric orbit that brings them out to us, it's not necessarily easy to see them because we've got to look towards the sun. That's one of the things. Objects that are in very eccentric orbits coming from the poles of the solar system often are also hard to find because they're out there in directions we don't normally look. And so, yes, we need to look for it, but I wouldn't be biting my nails. This is not the prime concern of our future.
On the wildcard line, David's with us, Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Dave, go ahead.
Oh, how you doing, George?
Great.
I got to meet Neil Armstrong, gentlemen.
Oh, cool.
I was 14 years old. I used to live in a little town called Sterling, Ohio. It was off Interstate 71. There was a gas station. So me and my friends were riding our bicycles to get baseball cards at the gas station. Up pulls up a red Mustang, and we noticed it was Neil Armstrong, so one of the guys says he won't take time to talk to us. But I yelled, "Hey, Mr. Spaceman," like that. He walked over. We introduced ourselves, and he shook our hands. And it felt like shaking hands with Christopher Columbus for what he did, you know, on the moon. And it's as a 14-year-old, I still have not forgot that day. And just to meet somebody that actually walked on the moon.
Yeah.
Neil Armstrong was an interesting guy. He became a teacher, university professor, and for most of his life, following the Apollo missions, he was a teacher. You could go to his university and take his classes and be taught aviation and aerodynamics from Neil Armstrong. He was very open to teaching the subject and talking to ordinary people. I wouldn't say hated the press, but he avoided the press like a plague.
Yeah, he was pretty quiet. When he landed on the moon and came back, Robert, he was pretty quiet. You would think that people would be all over, he'd be on talk shows and everything. He wasn't that way.
No, he was. This was a question of ethics and honor with him. He was focused on making that achievement. That's what his goal was. He was not interested in becoming a celebrity. He was interested in that. And because he was interested in that, in aviation, in flying, in aerospace, he became a teacher to teach the later generations how to do it after him.
Did you know Apollo 14's Edgar Mitchell?
No, I never met Edgar Mitchell.
Great guy.
Yeah, he's a good guy. You know, any of these guys, I've met a lot of astronauts and interviewed a lot of astronauts, both in the United States and in Russia, and they routinely open and friendly and willing to talk, especially if your goal is to get the facts right. Since that's my goal, and I can proudly say that everyone I've ever interviewed for anything I've ever written, once they've read what I've written, have always been glad to talk to me again, and that's the same with the astronauts. And so they've always been decent. People, especially from the earlier generations in the 60s, they understood this is hard. They're very humble. They tend to be very humble. They in many ways, they recognize they're not really that much better than anybody else. They just have some particular skills that make it possible to do this particular thing well. And that humbleness is really a pleasure to deal with when you deal with them, because they don't treat you like dirt. They treat you like an equal human being.
Let's go to Joe, Long Island, New York. Hello, Joseph. Go ahead.
Yeah, Bob, two quick questions. First would be, now that they might have Taurus, could they design a Romeo-type Star Trek ship to just orbit the Earth for tourists? Is there capabilities of doing that? I know you wouldn't be able to prep these people to go to the moon, probably. You know, a guy like Bezos couldn't really be easily prepped to do that. My second question would be about, you said the astronauts did not make errors. Two parts to this question. What would you speculate they could have done wrong that might have been not necessarily catastrophic but dangerous? And with the fighter jets, obviously you know what some of the errors they've made. You know, having studied that, what errors did some of those fighter jet pilots make?
Well, Joe, on your first question, I mentioned this already. SpaceX has a customer who has purchased a lunar or a flight around the moon.
Eight tickets, huh?
He's going to take. His name is Yuzuke Miyazawa. He's a Japanese billionaire. He's going to take eight people with him, and their training will be nothing like the astronauts. They're going to be on a spaceship as tourists. And so that's definitely doable. Human beings can do this kind of stuff. So we're not – one of the things we must abandon is this concept that this is a special thing for special people that only the government can approve, like NASA. This is like America originally. Anyone who wants to do it can do it, and they should be able to do it, and they should be allowed to do it. No one should stop them. And so, no, it's totally possible. And, in fact, I mentioned Axiom, the company, is building modules that are going to be initially attached to ISS, and then they will be flying free as Axiom's private space station for tourists and other purposes. And so, yes, this is going to be orbiting the Earth and as a space station for commercial activity, including tourism. Now, as to your second question, what could the astronauts have done that would have been catastrophic? Almost anything.
Anything. I was going to say that.
Anything. That's what's so miraculous. One of the examples I give in my book, Genesis, the story of Apollo 8, the first orbiting mission to go to the moon. It was the first mission anyone ever went to another world. It'll always be the first mission that went to another world. The computer they had on board that spaceship was less powerful than a simple calculator that can just add, subtract, divide, and multiply.
Our smartphone has more power.
Oh, your smartphone has tens of thousands times more power. It's not. I'm talking about a simple. I mean, a lot of people today don't even know what a simple calculator is. But just a simple calculator, where you could just simply press buttons and do adding, which a digital calculator, adding, subtracting, plus, minus. That, in many ways, was more powerful than the computer on the Apollo 8 mission. So you ask, what could they have done catastrophically? Almost anything. They were asked to do great things, and as human beings can do great things if they're asked. One of the stories I tell about Apollo 8 is the ground computers were large, and they could do a lot of very complicated calculations. So what they would do when they wanted to calculate the exact length and power of a engine firing to change orbit or position, the ground would do the calculations, and then they would read up a sequence of numbers to the astronauts, who would write them down and then repeat them back, and then they would manually enter those numbers into their little computer, and that would then fire the engines. But think about that. They're reading the numbers off over the comm lines. The astronauts writing them down and then repeating them back and then manually entering them into that little computer. You don't think something could go wrong?
Exactly. Robert, we're going to come back and take final calls with you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, Jeffrey Seelman joins us as we talk about negative and demonic spirits, so make sure you're part of the program. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you, along with Robert Zimmerman, our space historian. His website, BehindTheBlack.com. We'll get to your calls as well. Exciting stuff these days, though, Robert. You got to admit that, huh?
Oh, God. this is the kind of stuff that I really dreamed would be happening when I was a young 20-year-old back in the 70s, I thought, and I'm not alone in this, that we were going to the stars and the planets and we'd be doing this regularly. And unfortunately, the United States abandoned the American ideas of freedom and instead copied the Soviet Union for the next half century, and thus we accomplished very little. And only in the last decade has the United States begin to return to its American ideals of freedom, competition, private enterprise. in its space exploration, and the result has been breathtaking. In only a decade, it's been breathtaking, and in the next decade, it's going to be far more breathtaking, so much so that it's going to be hard to breathe for a lot of people who follow this.
Why, for years, we had nobody doing it privately, and now all of a sudden we've got three competitors?
Well, for many, many years, the federal government acted to squelch private enterprise. Shortly after the beginning of the space race in the 1960s, there was a passion among private communications companies to start launching satellites, their own private constellations, to provide global telephone, television service worldwide. Kennedy and Congress stepped in and said, no, it can only be done by a quasi-private, government-controlled company called ComSat. And so for the next decade, private companies, communications, and television companies were forbidden in the United States to launch their own satellites.
They had to depend on
this government company. Didn't change until like the Nixon administration in the early 70s. And then in the post-Apollo, with the coming of the shuttle, Congress then declared that all American launches would be on the shuttle. No government would be the only launch service, so it literally put almost all the launch companies out of business. And it wasn't until after the Challenger accident when Reagan said no more commercial flights on the shuttle that you started to get a slow recovery in the American launch industry. But that industry was so hobbled that it literally took the arrival of a outsider to finally bring it back to life, and that was Elon Musk.
Back to the calls. Let's go to Jeff in Goldsboro, North Carolina, on the wild card line. Hello, Jeffrey. Go ahead.
Hi, Robert. Hi, George.
Hey, Jeff.
Thanks for taking my call. Congrats to Bezos and Branson for their accomplishments the last couple of weeks.
Absolutely.
And good luck to the Russians. They're launching their multi-purpose laboratory module tomorrow to the ISS called Nauka, and I hope that goes well. My question is to both of you, actually. NASA has just issued a request for proposal to develop a commercial space station study. It's valued at about $400 million over the next 4 years if they get the funding. And they're looking to pick 2 to 4 companies to do the study proposal due by 26 August. And it would be a perfect opportunity for Bob Bigelow's inflatable habitat technology and an opportunity for him to bid on that. So how come Bob Bigelow has shut down Bigelow Aerospace right when it looks like it could come to some fruition and he could get some payback on his technology development? And I'd like you both to answer that because you both know Bob Bigelow. So was it a matter of funding? Was it a matter of he lost interest? Or how come he shut down Bigelow Aerospace?
George, you want to go first?
I'll go first. You know, he generated most of his money from his hotel groups, and I think they've been very slow because of the COVID situation. I got to think, Robert, that and Jeff, that this has to do with finances. He doesn't have the Bezos, Elon Musk type money at all. Robert?
I would say that's part of it, but I would say there's another component, and the contract request for proposals that NASA issued is an example of that. There is a turf war going on, and Axiom is an example of a company that has a lot of former NASA insiders in its management, and so there was a little bit of favoritism there, and Bigelow was pushed to the side. He was an outsider, and NASA would rather work with its buddies, and so the management of Axiom was at an advantage, and that pushed Bigelow to the side. And this new proposal by NASA is interesting because the coming space stations are not that'll be a payoff to these stations. You know, I would say they'd make a very big mistake taking any government money. They're going to be able to make more than enough cash profits on their own. If they take government money, it's going to slow down their operations significantly. A fine example of that is what happened to Blue Origin. It was going great guns, and then it decided to take military money to help develop its New Glenn rocket, orbital rocket, and suddenly development slowed 1 to 2 years behind schedule. And I think that's because they had to meet suddenly all these government requirements.
Amazingly, Bigelow was one of the first private people to be interested in doing his own space thing.
That's correct. And it is a tragedy that he's kind of on the outs now to a certain extent. I really feel strongly that he should have been one of these players right now, but he is not. And the finance issue that you raised, George, I think is really a factor here. There's no doubt about that. But I think there are other political insider-outside games being played that worked against him.
Nancy in Houston, Texas. Hi, Nance. Go ahead.
Yes, I have a question for your guest.
Sure.
He mentioned space travel or tourism, but to me, don't you have to have a screening process? Are these people physically fit? Do they have a heart condition, mental? I feel like just because you have the money, can you just punch your ticket and get on board? I would assume something like this, wouldn't they need a comprehensive screening process?
That's an interesting question.
Nancy, do you have to do such a thing to get on an airplane? No, you
no,
do not.
No, not at all.
No, you do not. And in an America that once existed, no one would have dreamed of asking that kind of question, to put that kind of restrictions on private companies and private individuals. It would be up to them to make the choice. The companies are not going to take people that are physically unhealthy because there's a liability risk. And so they're going to screen.
Is it more taxing to go into space physically, Robert?
Say again?
Is it more taxing to go into space physically?
Yeah, of course there's some taxing. You know, it's high G-forces you have to do on the launches, but the difference is not significant. If you're healthy, you can go. John Glenn flew to the, was he in his 70s when he went to ISS? The issue here is if you're healthy, reasonable health, there's no reason why you can't go, and it should be the decision of the private company and the individuals who want to fly. This has nothing to do with the government. And for Americans to now say, we should have some kind of screening process and we should decide for others whether they should go or not, I find it offensive beyond words.
Let's go to Barry in Rock Hills, South Carolina. Hello, Barry.
Hello there, George. Martha and I are sitting here listening to the show. I was just talking to Tommy, and I'm sure both of y'all know the answer to this question, but what is Robert Zimmerman, what rock star has the same name as him?
Bob Dylan.
That's exactly right, and I knew you would know it.
As a matter of fact, you have no idea how many emails I got from people who said, why isn't Bob Dylan the singer on?
I have a sweeter voice.
Oh, yeah, right. Well, listen, here's my question for you, and hello to all my audience buddies out there. What do you guys feel like is on the dark side of the moon? Any kind of civilization, any kind of creatures alive?
Right now, the only artificial entity on the far side of the moon, on its backside that we don't see from the Earth, the only artificial entity that's there right now is a Chinese rover, U-2, and its lander, Chang'e 4. There are no civilizations on the far side of the moon, nor on the near side. It's a dead planet that we could use as our initial base of operations for learning how to build colonies on other worlds, but there is no civilizations there. The Chinese, though, have their rover. It's gone about 1,100 feet of travel over 2 years. It's been a very big success for them because that's a challenging thing to do, and they did it.
I will say that Ingo Swan, the remote viewer who worked in a government program, claims that there are structures, Robert, on the far side of the moon.
Well, that's nice. That's nice, but he's wrong.
Well, let me ask you, do you believe that there is life out there in space?
Oh, George, I must tell you ask me that question every time.
I know, but we have new people listening all the time.
Every single time. I think that it would be foolish to assume there are not life on other worlds, but we don't know. There are, as Carl Sagan said, there are billions and billions of uncountable number of planets, so the odds are very, very high. However, there is a fundamental question that we should ask ourselves. We have been looking at the stars now with high technology now for more than a half century, looking for any kind of signal that might suggest an alien civilization, and we've detected nothing. Where are they? Why aren't they responding? it's a question that we have to ask ourselves, because you would think we hear something from some alien civilization at some point down the road, and we have not. So that's a question that we as humans on Earth, there is that possibility that, yes, there is going to be in the universe many different civilizations and alien societies, but it very could be there has to be a first. And my gosh, there is the possibility we are it. Don't know yet, but that's where I answer.
But
that's
so many people are reporting strange things.
Yeah, that's
even
nice.
Pilots.
I mean, you know, but I've never yet found any of these reports, when looked at really, really closely, as credible. That's how I've looked at it. They might, you know, it's possible. I don't dispute it. I'm, you know, science. You're a good scientist doesn't just say no, it's wrong. But I've never seen anything that's really, to my mind, strongly credible in almost all those reports.
Next up, we've got Rob in Longview, Washington, west of the Rockies. Hey, Rob, let's get you in here.
Hi, George. Thank you for taking my call. Love this show.
Thank you, sir.
Hi, Robert. You're a very learned man. I really respect your views on everything.
Thank
you. I have a question. As you know, they found that huge, huge comet that's barreling into our solar system, and it's due to approach, I believe they said, in 2031.
Correct.
The AUs or AIs, the astronomical units, I guess, which is the distance. One AU is the distance from Earth to Sun. I guess it's going to be about 20 or 30 AUs from the Sun when it comes barreling through. My question is this. Can they take Hubble telescope and get a really good picture of this giant comet, or is it too dim to really focus in on it?
Rob, let me be very quick on this. Hubble was designed to look at very small, faint objects. It was also designed to be able to also observe objects in the solar system away from the sun, like Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, etc. And so, yes, Hubble is going to be if it's operating, is going to be a prime instrument for looking at this comet. It is a very large size comet. It's probably not going to be visible to our eyes because it's not getting that close to the sun. There's already detected some activity there, which is kind of cool. It's very far out. And it's going to take a long time. 31 is the correct year when it's going to be its closest. But its closest is going to be something like the orbit of Saturn. You might know the number more precise. So it's not getting really close to the sun, but it's going to get close enough that if it's a really ancient primitive object, it could very well be heated up enough that you'd see a coma and maybe a tail. And so Hubble is going to be aimed at it, I guarantee it. And we'll get images, guarantee it.
Robert, what fascinates you about space?
I'm interested in exploration, pushing the unknown. That's always been my interest. When I write about science, it's no different. You know, climbing a mountain is going where no one's ever gone before. Going into a new cave, which I have done, and going where no one's ever gone for, is exploration. Trying to find out something that no one has ever discovered before in all fields of science is going where no one's ever gone before. So that's what interests me. And I think that space exploration, above all, illustrates the nobility of that human endeavor to try to push that unknown, no matter how hard or difficult it is. And so that's why I write about it.
Is your latest book Conscious Choice?
My latest book, Conscious Choice, is a history, and it's actually a history of early colonial America. But I wrote it because early colonial America illustrates for us very well the things we could do right and wrong in future colonies. And it provides us lessons about what to avoid to make the colonies of the future on Mars the just, prosperous, good places to live that the United States became here in North America. And that's why I wrote the book. And so you learn a great deal about early colonial history, specifically about the origins of slavery in Virginia. Why did that go wrong? And that teaches us lessons about what to avoid on Mars.
Interesting. And I'll always love your book, Genesis, The Story of Apollo 8.
Thank you, George.
It's really great. Robert, thanks for being on the program. Keep in touch, and let's keep our fingers crossed about what happens in space, all right?
Yeah, absolutely, George, absolutely.
Robert Zimmerman, his website, Behind the Black. Up next, Jeffrey Seelman joins us. One of his books is called Power Protection, Learn Psychic Protection, Home Business Protection, and Clearing. We're going to talk about the increase, and there is, of negative and demonic spirits and how they manifest destructive forces to take advantage of us. Also, don't forget our free YouTube channel. Just put in Coast to Coast AM Official in the YouTube search bar and sign up. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Don't touch your dial. We will be right back.